In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Since you're listening to this podcast, we have a very special offer for you. You can try 6 issues of BBC History Revealed magazine for just £9.99. That's a saving of 70% on the shop price. BBC History Revealed is the all-action history magazine suitable for the whole family. To find out more and take advantage of this offer, visit buysubscriptions.com/podcast. And if you're based in the US, you won't miss out. You can try 3 issues for just £9.95, saving a huge 70%. For more details, visit buysubscriptions.com/podcast. Both these offers end on the 15th of May, 2021. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. 70 years ago, Britain was preparing to throw a party. The Festival of Britain, staged in the summer of 1951, was intended as a celebration of an exceptional nation rising from the ruins of war and looking towards a bright future. And it certainly was a big hit with the public. That summer, millions of Britons descended on London's South Bank and exhibitions across the 4 nations to take in an event that dominated Britain's cultural landscape for 4 months. Harriet Atkinson recently wrote a feature about the festival for BBC History Magazine. And here, in conversation with our production editor, Spencer Mizzen, she talks us through some of the festival highlights and argues that though it was designed as a great celebration of Britishness, this was an event with a surprisingly international flavour.
Harriet, your feature in our May issue tells the story of the Festival of Britain, a 4-month celebration of Britishness that was staged across the UK in 1951, which is 70 years ago this summer. Now, you write near the beginning of the piece that Clement Attlee's Labour government saw the festival as a means of promoting Britain as a model democracy. It's a time of deteriorating relations between the communist East and the capitalist West. I just wonder if you could explore that point in a little more detail. I mean, what was the government aiming to achieve by putting on the festival?
Well, the initial peg for the festival had actually been the centenary of 1851, the Great Exhibition, which had happened at Crystal Palace. But actually, as soon as the government, Clement Attlee's government, got into the planning process, that peg was sort of soon forgotten, really, although it was occasionally referenced here and there. I mean, the sort of simple reason for staging it was to give people a lift and to give people a tonic to the nation, as they call it, after the privations of war. But there were various political arguments that were also mounted. One of them was this point of showing Britain as this model democracy as the sort of storm clouds of the Cold War gathered. So Britain could be put on a stage and shown to be able to operate in a way that was distinctive and different. The sort of economic argument for the festival was that it was going to be a trade and cultural exhibition. It was supported by the Board of Trade. The president, Stafford Cripps, had made an argument for it. So it was to boost trade. And there was this idea of the festival being a chance to show British reconstruction in action. So action around, you know, building new housing and putting on show, putting on exhibition, the sorts of things that were happening in order to bring Britain back after the war. So there were a complex set of considerations going on there. And some of them were based on this idea of presenting British democracy to the world.
Now, you say that the festival was, to some extent, intended as a shot in the arm to a nation still coming to terms and suffering from the economic consequences of 6 years of conflict. But was the festival aimed principally at the people of Britain, or was it more aimed to the watching world?
Both, really. So it was a story, as they called it. It was a story about the British contribution to civilization, as its organisers saw it. It was about the British people and the land they lived in and lived by, as in the words of its organisers. This was a story really for the people of Britain to reflect on. So the organisers were also calling it an autobiography. So it was almost as if it was reflecting back to the British people their own history and their own experiences. But then there was, of course, an earnest attempt to bring people from overseas. And there was a big marketing campaign, for example, with London buses that were all made into little exhibitions of their own in advance of the festival to take it around to Europe and also to the States in order to sell the idea and to bring people over. So both, really. But I guess the main audience was British people.
Cool. So we've talked about the aims of the festival. Now, can we turn to sort of the content of the festival? I wonder if you could talk us through what you consider to be some of the highlights of the Festival of Britain.
Yes. I mean, the first thing that I would say about that is that people often think about the festival as being just about the South Bank. It's about the festival hall on the South Bank of the Thames and about those very notable symbols, the Skylon, which shot in the air, and this enormous Dome of Discovery, which was built there, which were the sort of spectacular centrepieces of the festival. But the thing I've always thought was very interesting, and I think is not so well known, is the fact that the Festival of Britain was about showing the whole of Britain, and it did take place across the whole country. So in addition to the South Bank exhibition, there were seven other major exhibitions that were mounted at the same time. Three of them were in London. One was in Lansbury, in the East End of London. It was about live architecture. It was about showing an area under reconstruction being built. There was a big exhibition of science and innovation in science at the South Kensington, the Science Museum, as it is now. There were the pleasure gardens, which are often remembered at Battersea Park. And then there was a major exhibition at Belfast of farm and factory in a suburb of Belfast at Castlereagh. There was a very large exhibition as well in Glasgow, and that was an exhibition of power. So it was showing modern technologies of hydroelectricity, for example. And then there were two others that were taken round the country as travelling exhibitions for people who couldn't get to the major others. So one was aboard a decommissioned aircraft carrier, the HMS Campania, and that was like a miniature replica of what was happening at the South Bank. And that went to all sorts of ports around the edge, around the coast of Britain. And then there was a final one which went round on lorries and was constructed in various places. So, and then in addition to these major exhibitions, there were a whole lot of arts festivals that happened all over the place, and a lot of local organising went on. And so town and village councils would think of ways of brightening up villages. So they created bench schemes and new signage and parties and dressing up and little competitions and, you know, sort of other ways of celebrating the festival. So bell ringing and bonfires were burnt and all sorts of other creative ways of marking this moment, including you know, magazines creating stitching embroidery sets that were bought. And so actually there was a sort of proliferation of things that went on. Some of them probably would have happened in the summer of 1951 anyway, but became overbranded as festival events or sort of manifestations of the festival.
So did the people of Britain really buy into the festival? Would you deem it a success in terms of how it was received by the public?
Well, I think broadly, yes, it was, in that 8 million people went to the South Bank exhibition and 13 million people, more or less, went to the exhibitions around the country and to the arts festivals and so on. So, I mean, many, many people went to some part of the Festival of Britain. But there was, of course, resistance as well, for all kinds of reasons. I mean, one of the major reasons why there was resistance was because, of course, this was a moment when Britain was massively in debt, when we were still recovering from the war, when rationing was still continuing, and there were lots of material shortages. So broadly, people critics on the left were worried that resources, manpower would be diverted away from the important work of reconstruction and building houses and so on. And then there were others on the right who criticised it because it was a waste of money. And there was an MP, a Conservative MP called Waldron Smithers, who criticised this squandermania that he saw the Attlee government being sort of finding itself just spending money on all sorts of things. In his eyes, there were also people who thought of it as being a sort of vanity project for the Attlee government and a form of propaganda. So that was the sort of political response was divided. There were lots of people who had sort of cultural objections to it, who thought that it was just unnecessary. The novelist Evelyn Waugh wrote about these monstrous constructions appearing on the South Bank of the Thames, for example. The conductor, Thomas Beecham, saw the Royal Festival Hall for the first time and again called it ugly and monstrous. There were other critics who thought that the architecture was very parochial, that this was a sort of outburst of xenophobia. So architectural critic Rainer Banham, for example, wrote a piece saying that this was a manifestation of xenophobia. People who visited, on the whole, enjoyed it and had positive things to say, positive memories. People were amazed by how expensive the food was, for example, and so one critic wrote about how rubbish the food was in these open air cafes, and that it was more expensive than going to the Ritz. There were a range of responses. Overwhelmingly, I would say people were positive, but there were quite a lot of reasonable objections, I think.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
It's become a political symbol for a cultural event that managed to bring people together. And I think in a way that's one of its legacies, is that it's become this political symbol, a symbol of something that was offered in that moment which worked, a political project which actually met the mark.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
In light of the fact that the festival was imbued with patriotism, it was a celebration of Britishness. I mean, one of the most interesting angles in your feature is the fact that architects and designers born outside of Britain, many of whom were refugees from Nazis, they made an enormous contribution to the festival, didn't they? Which is probably unseen by most of the visitors. So that leads me to two questions, really. Why was the contribution of foreign-born creatives so significant to the festival? And following on from that, could you introduce us to some of those foreign-born designers?
Absolutely. I mean, it is a really intriguing aspect of the festival, and actually is something that I've only started to think about more recently, this issue of where people had come from in order to take part. It's something that the historian David Cesarani writes about. This makes this point about the fact that the Festival of Britain was one of a series of key moments in the 20th century when immigrants and refugees developed and defined English culture and heritage. And I found that a really intriguing idea. And it's something that I've only sort of followed up in the last 2 or 3 years. But I'm very struck by this point that actually there were many, many creatives who worked on the Festival of Britain. There were 40 architectural practices just at the South Bank alone. There were 99 designers working on the festival at the South Bank, and then many, many beyond. But many of them were not born in Britain. Many of them had come from sort of a dispersed series of locations. So there were designers who were born in Russia and Poland and Hungary and Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, Germany, Austria, who all came and worked on these events. A number of them had been interned during World War II as enemy aliens. Some of them, for example, the artist Hans Feibusch, had his work had been shown in the notorious 1937 Degenerate Art exhibition in Munich, the Nazi exhibition. So they all arrived many of them arrived during the 1930s, and then were just beginning to set up fledgling practices at the time of the Festival of Britain. So just to think about three of those designers, I'll just talk about three that particularly interest me. And there are many, many, as I've said, there are dozens of people who were not born in Britain who were contributing in that moment. The three that I'm most interested in are Misha Black, Jacqueline Grug, and F.H.K. Henrian. So Misha Black was born in Russia, in the city of Baku, which is now part of Azerbaijan. He'd arrived in Britain in 1912. His family had been part of an earlier wave of migration to Europe, escaping Jewish persecution from the Russian Empire. At 38, he was appointed to this major role on the Festival of Britain. He was part of the major design team overseeing all of the events. He also oversaw major parts of the South Bank exhibition and lots of the displays, for example, inside the Dome of Discovery and the Regatta restaurant and various other aspects. He was a really formidable designer. He worked for many extraordinarily well-known clients during his life. He went on to design, for example, the much admired Westminster City street signs, the red and the black. He also worked very closely with London Underground and British Rail, designing the look of those services. So he was very interesting and very pivotal to the Festival of Britain. Jacqueline Groeg had been born in Prague, in the former Czechoslovakia. She had worked in Germany and Austria in Prague, and then came to Britain in 1939 on the eve of the Second World War. She worked with Misha Black on elements of the Dome of Discovery. She was a very interesting textile designer, and she designed a screen in the Dome of Discovery for the Living World section, which is all of sort of simulated bones. It was very, very, it was a really interesting piece of design. And the third designer whose work was important in the festival and who is interesting was F.H.K. Henry. And he was a graphic designer. He was German. He'd lived and worked in Paris and Tel Aviv before he came to London in 1936. He worked in the festival on the country and the natural world displays. He had been interned on the Isle of Man in during 1940 and then went to the Ministry of Information. And he ended up having a practice that was really extraordinarily influential in all sorts of the kind of corporate branding that we now identify, things like Tate and Lyle sugar. He designed the brand for that, and many other corporate identities that we will all now be familiar with. British based people will be familiar with. So those are three of them, but there are, as I say, many, many others who are very interesting.
Did the presence and the influence of so many foreign-born creatives, I mean, did that provoke any resistance?
Mainly, designers felt welcomed. That's the overriding impression that I have from the interviews that I did and the archival research I've done, is that these designers felt welcome and that it was a really important staging post in careers. But there were subtle signs of resistance and discrimination, I suppose. I interviewed Charles Pluvier, who was an administrator in the festival office, and he recalled having found a memo where his name was underlined and someone had written, "I thought this was supposed to be the Festival of Britain," because clearly the implication being that his name didn't sound British. There were also suggestions, interestingly, Misha Black was awarded an OBE after the festival. At the same time, some of his colleagues and contemporaries were awarded knighthoods. And there was some suggestion in his archive, which I've looked at, which is at the V&A, that some of his colleagues and contemporaries definitely thought that there was discrimination in that choice, that he had only been honoured with an OBE when some of his contemporaries had been given something more. Misha Black had, in fact, only become naturalised as a British citizen on the eve of the Festival of Britain in 1950. He'd tried before that. I would say it was subtle, if discrimination existed, rather than there being an overt feeling.
How did the diversity of the designers shape the festival itself? I mean, can a continental influence be detected in the work and the designs and the exhibitions in Britain that summer?
Yes, I think the answer is yes. Although, of course, the impact of that influence was dispersed, because it wasn't through any one medium. The architects, the designers, the craftspeople, the artists were all working across different media. And they'd all been, of course, everyone had come from different locations, from different kinds of technical and creative training. So I think one can see it, but it's not particularly easy to sort of quantify what that was. But certainly, if you look for influences of, say, the new typography, which was within the kinds of choices of typeface, for example, and choices of fabrics and materials and forms, there are definitely traces of all sorts of influence, from surrealism to constructivism to several of the kind of European avant-garde movements that were all coming together in that moment.
And how unique on an international scale was the Festival of Britain. Were there any other comparable grand national events being staged in other nations at this time?
One of the things that was unique about the festival was this strange idea of sort of inverting the World's Fair model. So instead of it all being, as the Crystal Palace had been, for example, all staged in on one site in that moment, the 1851 kind of Hyde Park, you know, you all came, you saw the world in a single place. What the festival did was to assemble a whole nation on show across the whole nation. So it was almost like an inversion of that. And I don't think that anything had quite been done in that way before. There were other events that in just prior to the festival that were very influential on it. For example, there was a major exhibition at Stockholm in 1930, which was very focused on the land and landscape as the festival was. There was also a major exhibition in Zurich a few years before the festival, the Landi, as it was colloquially known. And that was again focused on land and landscape. And there were all sorts of ideas of landscaping that were brought to the South Bank from that exhibition. There was also a big exhibition called in Wrocław in Poland that had all sorts of similar visual cues and landscaping tropes. So the designers of the Festival of Britain travelled around looking at shows and gathering influences, and so quite a lot of those can be seen in the Festival of Britain.
If you could go back and visit just one of the installations or exhibitions that were put on 70 summers ago, which one would you choose?
One of the very odd things, and the very sort of unknown, I think, aspects of the South Bank was how much attention they paid to making the landscaping rather like a visit to the countryside. One of the things that's very strange in photographs is the way that dry stone walls and geological features are brought to the South Bank site and reconstructed so that you'd have a feeling almost as if you were on a day out in the countryside, but in the middle of London. And that has always really intrigued me. And partly that intrigues me because it would be interesting to see what it would be like to see those features by the Thames there in the middle of London. But also intrigues me because clearly these architects and designers who were so interested in giving a glimpse of the future were also deeply invested in the British landscape and in British countryside. The landscaping of the Festival of Britain site at the South Bank, attached as it was to the geology and the natural features, which were all brought for those months and put in situ with Yorkshire dry stone walls next to Derbyshire stone and all set up in this way. The poet W.H. Auden described this idea of British people who were attached to not only the British landscape, but the history of that landscape as topophiles. And I think what's very interesting is to me at least, is the way in which modern and modernist designers who were working on the Festival of Britain also had this topophile tendency. They were deeply invested in the picturesque and in deep sort of love of the land and thinking about the land and about the sort of spiritual qualities almost of the land of Britain.
Finally, Harriet, how do you think the Festival of Britain changed Britain?
Well, I think it succeeded in giving people a lift in its most immediate form. So there are many accounts of people reminiscing about how it was the boost that they needed. It gave them, you know, a sensory kind of, you know, experience of bright colours and an enjoyment and a day out and their first taste of refrigerated milk and the first chance to dress up after the war. So in that sort of simple, immediate way, I think it succeeded in giving people a lift. How did it change Britain in the longer term? There were stylistic legacies, certainly. There, the idea of a festival style, you know, which people still talk about, with particular fonts and furniture and mass-produced homewares. There was a craze for atomic styling, which was based on festival patterning, this X-ray crystallography, which had been on show in the festival. The festival became a bit like a pattern book for urban planning. So lots of the development of the new towns drew on aspects that had been experimented with in festival exhibitions, perhaps at Lansbury or at the South Bank or beyond. The festival legitimised the role of the designer. That's one of the things that it did. And so it put on show the things that designers could do, and it launched many careers as well. So many architects and designers owed their collaborations to that moment. And so actually that's obviously played out over many decades, that particular impact. But also the festival, to come back to this point about the politics of mounting these events, it's become a political symbol for a cultural event that managed to bring people together. And I think in a way that's one of its legacies, is that it's become this political symbol, a symbol of something that was offered in that moment which worked, a political project which actually met the mark.
That was Harriet Atkinson. You can read her feature on the Festival of Britain in our May issue. That's on sale now and also includes pieces on the Peasants' Revolt, Napoleon and the history of slimming clubs. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. Join us tomorrow for an episode on the Vikings in Britain.